world that is more different from Christianity than Hinduism is. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that. Buddhism is also very different. But I remember last night Elizabeth Bettenhausen saying that art helps religion in the sense of helping us confront that which is different from ourselves. And in a sense, that's what we're doing here in studying other religions. Confronting something that is very different, but then seeing what we can learn from it. Just a very quick two-sentence review of what I talked about yesterday to put this in context. We reviewed some of the typical attitudes that Christians have had about other religions in the world. The most dominant one, of course, being that they're wrong, right? They're all false. They're all going to hell, or however it's phrased. The exclusionary attitude, where they are all heathen and pagans, and thus it is our mission as Christians to displace their religions and convert them to Christianity. Well, that's putting it a little bit bluntly, but then we critique that a little bit. It overlooks many things, but particularly we Christians believe that God is the creator of all people, and that these people of India and China and elsewhere are also children of God, and that therefore God is present with them. You know, so we can't just write them off like that. Then we looked at some other attitudes. A very popular one nowadays is a more relativistic attitude, which suggests that, you know, all of the religions are sort of like equal paths, all going up the mountain, reaching the summit together, right? God is the goal, and all of the religions are like different paths. But that's not very satisfactory either. So we talked briefly about some sort of new approaches or in-between approaches that Christians have struggled with to try and both maintain a commitment to Christianity as the ultimate truth and be able to respect and love people of other religions. And you know, one of the most interesting of those approaches that we talked about is the Roman Catholic theological idea that the other religions of the world are like Old Testament religions. Just like Judaism was an Old Testament religion, and its function was to prepare for the fulfillment in Christ, so we could think of the other religions of the world as preparatory, you know, and in that way respect them and so forth. But that's not very that's not completely helpful either, is it? Because if you tell other people of the world that their religion is preparing them for Christianity, that they're not going to think that that's a very good thing. They're not going to love you for that. So finally, what I suggested yesterday is that we need to explore some new ideas. All of these things that I've just mentioned, these theories or theologies about the place of other religions, have one thing in common, namely that all of those theories were constructed strictly from Christian material, right? From the Bible and from the Church Fathers and from Christian theology, without any attention being paid to these other people of the world. I think I mentioned yesterday that that's sort of like a male theologian constructing a theology of women's roles without ever talking to women, right? So here we are constructing a theology about other religions, and we've never even looked at them. So I suggested that maybe what we need to do today, as we rethink our Christian approaches, is to start listening to them. And I think there's very, very good Christian theological warrant for that. I suggested that the primary mission for Christians in the world, if we read the New Testament, is to be Christ's presence in the world. Right? As the Father has sent me, so I have sent you. So we are in the world as Christ's present. We are present to the people of the world as Christ. Now, what does it mean to be present to them? Well, it means many, many things, of course. It certainly means sharing everything that we know and experience and believe and so forth with these people. But you can't be present with someone without also respecting them and learning from them, right? If you're with somebody else and you do all of the talking and you've never listened to that other person, and you never let that other person affect you, then you haven't really been present, right? So with that kind of idea, what I'm suggesting to do now the rest of the week is to take little glimpses, as it were, at some of these different religions of the world. Now, you know, we don't have time, obviously, to go into to great detail or depth, but to open, you know, a little window and start listening to them. To do sort of like case studies with some of the major religions. Hinduism tonight, we'll look at Buddhism tomorrow, and so forth. And see what we find. That means we need to suspend our own theological judgment, right? You know, we come with all kinds of preconceived notions about these other religions as, you know, pagan and Christian, whatever else we think of them. Well, let's just lay that aside for the moment and try and listen to them. And as I said, we'll start with Hinduism. Keep a couple questions in mind as I'm talking. I'll try to do some talking for a while to just give you this little window into Hinduism. But then I would like you to react, because I know you all have ideas about these questions. Let's make it real simple. Why don't you think about just one or two questions that we can discuss a little bit later on. First question would be simply, what can we as Christians learn about God from Hindus? Maybe I should say, what if anything? What if anything we Christians can learn from Hindus? And then maybe a second question, a little bit more radical perhaps. Is it possible to find something of Christ in Hinduism? Now, the reason I ask that second question is I have in mind a very important book that was written by Raimondo Panikkar. If any of you interested in doing some reading, he is a Christian theologian whose father was Hindu and mother was Christian, Roman Catholic Christian. He's a very learned man. I think he's got 3 doctorates, one in chemistry, one in philosophy, one in theology. But his main task in life has been to try and enter into a dialogue with Hinduism, you know, which he's a Christian, but he knows Hinduism from within, and he's trying to bridge the gap, so to speak. He wrote many important books, but his best-known one is called The Unknown Christ of Hinduism. Like the Unknown Christ of Hinduism. So that's why I asked that second question. You know, is there something in Hinduism that suggests Christ to us? And can maybe even teach us something about Christ. But especially the first question, can we learn anything about God from Hindus? Okay, Hinduism, certainly one of the most fascinating religions of the world, at least for me. It's got such a long history. It doesn't really start anywhere. Hinduism is not a founded religion like Christianity or Islam. It just sort of grows from the soil of India. Now, of course, historically we know there were beginnings. Way, way back there in the 3rd millennium BC, there was a very advanced culture in the Indus Valley. We just call it the Indus Valley Civilization. It was like ancient Egypt and ancient Sumer. Agricultural civilization had developed writing and so forth, and worshiped fertility gods, goddesses particularly. And then we know that an invasion or an immigration took place of the Aryans from Central Asia. Now, the Aryans were Indo-European peoples, related to the Greeks and the Italics and the Balts and the Germans and so forth. They came down into India. That was about 1500 BC. And out of this mixing together of very different cultures, somehow or other, this religion of Hinduism developed over the course of 2,000 years. And it's so fascinating because within Hinduism, you can find almost all religious practices, almost anything you can think about or could possibly imagine, you will find in Hinduism. It's just all-encompassing. I'm sure that they could easily just encompass Christianity also. In fact, they do. I mean, they think of Christ as, somehow or other fitting in the total scheme of Hinduism. Well, what I want to do is just focus on a couple basic themes in Hinduism so that we can use that for our purposes in reflecting theologically. What is really central to this religion of that vast population of India, over 600 million, maybe 700 million? Well, Hinduism is what, at its heart, I think, Hinduism is what we sometimes refer to as a monism. Monism, of course, comes from the word for one. And we use that term to designate a religion that has a worldview that somehow or other all things are one. Right? All things hang together as one reality, one sacred reality. Right? We could use the word God for that, but that would be misleading. You know, everything is sacred. Everything is one reality. The Hindu word for that one reality is Brahman. So at least put that there. That's the ultimate, that's the sacred. Somehow or other, everything participates in that. This whole world is Brahman. You are Brahman, I am Brahman, everything is Brahman. Right? Now, notice how that contrasts right away with our Christian outlook. Or maybe I should say, how does that contrast right away with our Christian outlook?
It's inclusive instead of exclusive.
Well, it's certainly very inclusive. The Christian view is not necessarily exclusive, but it's different from a monism, right?
Mm-hmm. Traditionally, Christianity suggests that the creator and the creation are separate.
Right, exactly. That's the important point. Christianity is a monotheism, right? A monotheism, which means one God and the created world, the creation that the one God created. And they're not the same, right? We sometimes make a rather sharp division between God and the world. We wouldn't go around saying, you are God and I am God and, you know, these trees are God, or do we? But we do find God in nature, right? And we do find God in each other. Yet we do pretty much insist that God is separate from creation. So there are two realities. But the Hindu basic philosophy is that somehow or other it's all inclusive, right? Now certainly they have God and they have the world, but somehow or other at the heart of the philosophy it's all one sacred reality called Brahma.
No level.
Well, there are levels. I mean, you talk to different Hindu philosophers and you get all kinds of different perspectives on this. They have a long philosophical tradition. For 2,000 years they've been arguing what's the relationship between Brahman and the world. But they all finally agree that everything is Brahman, right? But, you know, then there are different qualities, different levels, and so forth. Maybe since you said that, we could make this kind of a distinction that I think will be a little bit helpful later on. The great philosopher Shankara, one of the outstanding thinkers of Hinduism, made a distinction between what he called nirguna, you know, need to pay attention to the words, but nirguna Brahman, which is Brahman without any qualities or conditions whatsoever. That is the ultimate reality, right? Everything is Brahman. But then he suggested there's also a sadguna aspect of Brahman, which is sort of the aspect of Brahman that merges or evolves into the world. Or at least is what we know. Let's say this becomes, first of all, God, Ishvara, and then somehow or other the world and we human beings are evolved from that or produced from that or something. So that on the one hand, we as humans can worship God as the aspect of Brahman that is sort of turned toward us, but at the highest level of truth, everything is Brahman and there isn't anything else, right? If you can follow that puzzle. This is the notion of different levels of truth, right? For those who are most spiritually perfected, they can understand this. That's all there is. For most of us, we need this kind of help to understand Brahma.
Do they recognize good and evil in the
Oh, there, no, no, there would be no, there would be no good and evil, because that is already a duality. And there are no dualities in Brahma. Just like, you know, God. Would you say there's good and evil in God? I don't know how. But no, Brahma is without conditions and qualities, thus without good and evil. Now, at this level, certainly there's good and evil. Now, that's sort of the basic underpinning of Hinduism. And I think you can probably see that's what allows for all of this diversity at different levels of understanding. But that's kind of getting ahead of ourselves. In addition to this notion of the one reality that encompasses everything or permeates everything, or however you want to understand it, Hinduism also has an interesting notion of existence. This part of it right down here. It is a cyclical notion, right? Everything goes in cycles, and that those cycles are called samsara. Somehow or other, the samsara world has evolved from Brahman, but it continues endlessly. It really doesn't have any beginning, and it doesn't have any end. So different from the Christian perspective, right, where there's a beginning when God created the world, and there will be an end of the world. Not so in Hinduism. There is really no beginning and there's no end. There's just constant evolution and devolution of the worlds. Just like waves on the sea, right? Without beginning and end. And that whole process is called samsara, the wheel of existence. The whole universe goes through that, but most importantly, we human beings are part of that process. Hinduism is a very practical religion. It focuses right in on human existence. So what is human existence all about? In Hinduism, the basic perspective is something like this. The real person, that is the real you and the real me, is not what we think it is, right? I think that I am this body and this mind and these feelings and whatever it is that makes up my self-identity. Wrong. That's part of this process. The real me is the inner soul, which they call the Atman. The inner sacred reality that in fact is the same thing as Brahman. It's identical with Brahman. That's the real you. It's without beginning, without end. It's never born, it never dies. It is the eternal soul. That's the true self-identity. Now what happens in a complicated process that we can't really spend any time on is the soul, because of ignorance, I don't know who I really am, right? I think that I am this, therefore I desire, right? Once I think that I'm a body and feelings and emotions and lusts and all the rest that make me up, then I desire things for myself, and thus I commit action. Now the Sanskrit word for action is karma. I'm writing sideways here. You can probably read it. Karma, and that's a key term. You've heard of karma. Karma simply means action. It refers to the law of cause and effect. Basically, every action must have its result. Now these actions that we do, that are done out of ignorance and desire, are particularly potent or sticky or hot actions, and they cause rebirth to take place. In other words, they cause the soul to be born or reborn in an existence. Right? That's how the soul gets embodied, incarnated. And then once, of course, the soul is incarnated, then you live your whole life ignorant, desiring, performing actions, and you build up a whole load of karma so that when your body dies, then the karma causes you to be born again, right? And the cycle just keeps going on. Rebirth after rebirth, redeath after redeath. Karma causing that process continually to go on. And the karma that you accumulate in this lifetime, of course, even determines what kind of lifetime you will have next. Right? You know, you're all in pretty good shape in this lifetime, but some of the Hindu sacred texts say you will become what you desire. Right? What you desire and then act on those desires, that's what you'll become in your next lifetime. You know, so the Hindu scriptures tell you to think about it, you know. Are you going to wind up as a snake in the next lifetime, or you know, an elephant, or maybe as a god, you know? Gods are a part of this process too. So the rebirth possibilities are endless. Every living being in the world is an Atman and has been reborn as that particular living being because of karma built up in the past existence. So it's a very fascinating idea. So different, once again, from the Christian notion that somehow or other you are in charge of your own fate, as it were. What you are doing and desiring is what you will become. So it's fascinating, but for our purposes, we need to note that the goal of Hinduism as a religion is not just to perpetuate that cycle, right? It's a cycle of pain and suffering, right? It's re-death after re-death. The goal is to be saved from that cycle, or be liberated, we should say. That's called moksha, liberation or salvation, where the Atman gets rid of all ignorance, gets rid of all desire, thus gets rid of all karma that's done out of desire. And when that existence ends, since there's no karma left, the soul is liberated. And it rejoins, you can think of it that way, the Brahman is reunited, merges together with Brahman. And that's the goal. Okay. So with that kind of scheme in mind, then what kind of religious paths does Hinduism offer to its people? Now, obviously, everybody is not at the same level, right? We mentioned that before already. In fact, everybody is different. You know, each one of you, according to the Hindu thinking, is at a different spiritual level because you each have your own accumulation of karma that you have built up in past existences. It's made you what you are. And that's your spiritual level. And thus, Hinduism offers a religious path that is appropriate for all people at their different levels. That's why we should be careful, which I didn't do, but maybe just call your attention to it, not to give the impression that Hinduism is just a single thing, right? Sometimes, you know, other religions appear that way, like Islam, we think, is just Islam, and maybe Christianity is just Christianity. But Hinduism is really made up of a whole series of religious paths. In fact, the very word Hinduism is an invention of Westerners. It's not a Hindu word. It's what we have used to put a tag on these religious practices, and we call it Hinduism, you know, so we can deal with it. But there are a variety of religious paths in Hinduism, depending upon your spiritual level. I'll just mention the main three of them. Fortunately, Hindu thinkers have gathered all of these practices together in three basic paths, fortunately for us. The first path is the path of knowledge. The second path is the path of action. And the third path is the path of devotion, or worship. Now, these aren't exclusive. It doesn't mean that you have to choose one or the other. Most Hindus probably participate to some extent in all three of them. But there very definitely is a focus. They may be focused specifically on the path of knowledge or very much active in the path of devotion or something. Just quickly then, the path of knowledge is the highest path, or at least most Hindu thinkers call it the highest path. Not everybody agrees with that, particularly those that are very much devoted to their gods. But the philosophers at least say the path of knowledge is the highest path because it is in the path of knowledge that you finally overcome ignorance. And then you achieve liberation. You reach the level of Brahman. Those following the path of knowledge fully and completely are sannyasis, right? They're withdrawers from society. Those are the holy men and women that you find so many of in India that have abandoned their possessions, their business, their home, their family, and have gone off and become wandering holy men. They're at the highest level. There are no attachments holding them any longer. They don't have any desires anymore. They've rooted out all desires and ignorance, and they spend their time meditating. And what they achieve in their meditation is the recognition or the realization that their Atman is really the same thing as Brahman. Right? They come to a self-realization. And that self-realization, according to Hindu thinking, is what leads to liberation. Once you find fully and completely realize your Brahman nature, then there's nothing else to need. Then you don't desire anything else any longer. You don't build up any more karma, and you're liberated. Okay? But obviously, that's a path only for a few. There are lots of them in India, lots of sannyasis and various gurus who are thought to be self-realized and swamis and so forth. But even though there are many of them, they're still kind of an elite few. So for most of the rest of the people, there are other paths. It still may be helpful to practice the path of knowledge, especially disciplines of meditation. Right? A lot of Hindus practice meditation, or yoga. You know what yoga is, that fits into the path of knowledge. Basically, both meditation and yoga have the function of withdrawing your senses from this outer world, from being attached to all of these things out here, and turning it inward and finding the sacred reality within. Right? That's basically what meditation does. But the path of action is for everybody, not just for the sannyasis. Basically, what that practice involves is performing your proper role according to your particular place in life. Right? You all have been born at a particular place in life because of your karma from past existences. Now, the idea in Hinduism is that the best way to get rid of karma is simply to live and do what's expected of you. Because if you're doing what's expected of you, then you're not doing it out of desire. Right? The Bhagavad Gita, this famous scripture in India, goes to great lengths explaining to people how there's a big distinction between actions done out of desire, where you want something for it, right? You want a reward for what you're doing, and actions done simply because it's your duty. In Hinduism, that's called dharma. Perhaps you've heard of that. Dharma means the order of things. Each one of you has your own particular dharma, based upon your birth. Your dharma indicates what class you belong to. You know the famous caste system in India, where there's a priestly caste, a warrior caste, a producer caste, a slave caste, a subcaste, and then there are thousands of subcastes. Everyone is born into one of those, and that's part of your dharma. So if you're born as a grave digger, which is a subcaste, then performing your dharma would mean to be a good grave digger. Wanting to be something else would be desire, right? And that would build up bad karma. So the path of action is a very stabilizing social force. In fact, it keeps things from changing, because everyone simply is taught to do their duty, and that builds up good karma. And if you build up good karma, then that will cause better rebirths, right? So the path of action basically is a long path in which, over many lifetimes, you have better and better rebirths until finally you are at the spiritual level to achieve liberation. But it's kind of the the social factor. Very important, and I've given it a little bit of short because you're not really ready for it, and if you have trouble just doing your duty, which most of, you know, Hindus have trouble doing that too, right? There's still the third path open to everybody, and this is without any class distinctions or sex distinctions or anything. You can worship the gods. Or you can worship your god. Getting back to what we first had up here, that side of Brahman that is turned to us manifests itself in gods. And you can devote yourself to your god. And that's a way of overcoming your karma and reaching better rebirths, or even being liberated by your god. So very many Hindus practice worship of the gods. I've got a few slides along just to give you some visual relief of the gods. You want to flip?
A quick question that I've had. Last time I received an overview of this, and I thought this was a really dumb question. I didn't ask it. Now I'm not so proud. If you're reborn into an animal life, mm-hmm. how do you ever break out of it, given those three paths?
Well, it's probably not too hard, because animals, I'm just speculating. Animals would tend to perform their dharma, right? If you're born as a tiger, well, you're supposed to be a good tiger. That, you know, whatever tigers do, it includes, you know, killing prey and raising your young and being a good tiger, you know. So that it's really only at the human level that we have the big problem, because at the human level we let selfishness get into it.
So there must be something with the word desire that has a uniquely human quality mm-hmm. about that type of desire versus mm-hmm. animal mm-hmm. instinct, which would not then
be. No, and that wouldn't be. No, that would be more dharma. And it is only at the human level that you can reach liberation, too. That's an important
right.
thing. You can't, even the gods can't reach liberation. And that's hard for us to comprehend. But the gods are part of the samsara cycle. It might be great to be a god because they live, you know, millions of years, and obviously they, you know, they have, I guess, a lot of power and pleasure. But eventually, their dharma, their karma runs out too, and they fall and have to be reborn. And it's really only at the human level, by making use of our mind and through meditation, that we can achieve that oneness with the Brahman that brings liberation. Well, I've got a few pictures. Let me just talk about the gods as I give you a little visual relief here. Here's one of those temples in India that just sort of grow out of the soil, like plants almost. It's almost organic. You find those all over India. This is obviously a very old one. Worshipping the gods is a very popular practice in the temples and in the streets. Here's a festival with a god so covered with flowers and garlands that you can't even see the image. But here's one of the great gods, one of the forms of Brahman as Brahman appears to us. This is the great god Vishnu. There are really three great gods in Hinduism. Vishnu is one of them, and if you worship Vishnu, Vishnu is everything for you. Vishnu is the creator. There's a whole mythology of Vishnu eternally reclining on his cosmic serpent and then being incited to action, and out of his navel grows a lotus blossom, and that evolves into the whole universe. And then after billions of years, he destroys it all, and it all devolves back into himself again. And then after millions of years, he evolves it all again. So there's a whole mythology of creation there that goes along with this idea that I was telling you about before. The other great god is Shiva, the dancing god, also the creator and the destroyer of the world. So the very famous image in which Shiva is basically constantly dancing out the creation and the destruction of the world. Right? At every moment, the world is being created and it's being destroyed. Shiva takes many interesting forms. You can't see this one too well, but it's a male-female image. The great gods are not really male, although sometimes they're described that way. They are male and female. And in this particular image of Shiva, you can see half is male and half is female, just to indicate that this is the totality of the divine power. Hinduism places a big emphasis on the feminine aspect of the sacred. There's the main image of Shiva, which is actually the phallic image and the female generative image, right? Male and female combined there. It's sort of a pillar and then a receptacle. And that's the main image of this great god, the union of male and female powers. This is also the image. But here you have a combination of Shiva and Durga, which is his female side. And the reason, there's all kinds of other symbols there, as you can see. But the reason Durga is important is because for many Hindus, she becomes the great god or goddess in her own right, as Durga or Devi, the mother goddess, worshipped as, you know, the womb that brings forth the whole world and so forth. So those are really the three great gods, Vishnu, Shiva, and the great goddess. And mostly Hindus will worship one or the other. Now, you can worship all three, but usually Hindus will just devote themselves to the great goddess, or they'll devote themselves to Vishnu, or they'll devote themselves to Shiva. Mm-hmm.
So you can be at the actual level and devotion level at the same time then, mm-hmm. whereas you could not be, say, at the devotion level and the knowledge level at the same time.
Well, there's a debate there.
Okay.
Shankara would say, no, you can't. Shankara would say, once you have reached that higher level of knowing the Brahman, then you realize that all of the rest of this is simply illusion. Use the word maya or illusion for that, right? So once you reach the top, then everything else just drops away. But Ramanuja, another philosopher, said, now wait a minute. He was a worshiper of Vishnu, and he said, really, worshiping Vishnu is the highest truth. You know, so it doesn't just fall away. So, you know, they argue among themselves. I got a couple more shots here of one of the favorite gods of Hindus, namely Krishna. An important idea in the gods of Hinduism is the notion of avatars or incarnations, very similar to the Christian notion of Christ as the incarnation of God. Krishna is the incarnation of Vishnu, who comes into the human world in order to destroy evil and and bring righteousness and so forth. And the stories about Krishna are among the most beloved for all Hindus. There are lots of stories about baby Krishna, how lovable he was, how baby Krishna teaches people to love God as a baby, right? Which is familiar to Christians, right? Baby Jesus. And then there are lots of stories about Krishna as a young man, with the so-called cowherd girls. He grew up in a rural village, and since he was a god, he was very attractive to all of these young women, and they would sneak out at night from their parents and their husbands, many of them were married, and go out and secretly dance with Krishna out in the forest. This, of course, is Krishna and all of the cowgirls around him. And there are many, many erotic stories about their meetings out here in the forest, particularly Radha, his favorite among these cowherd women. And then you have to ask the question, well, why is this in Hinduism? I mean, it gets actually very erotic. And Hindus would answer, well, there are many ways of loving God. You can love God as a father, love God as a mother, you can love God as a brother. Krishna has a brother, incidentally, who's also an incarnation of Vishnu. You can love God as a baby, but the highest form of loving God is to love God as a lover. And, you know, the reason for that is all the other forms of love has some kind of obligation connected to them. You ought to love your father, you ought to love your baby, you ought to love your brother, you ought to love your mother, but you really oughtn't to love your lover in this way, because these are actually illicit meetings. This is a totally free and spontaneous kind of love, and according to Hinduism, that's the highest form of loving God. Well, it took me a little longer than I hoped to give you even that little window into Hinduism, and I had hoped to have you discuss among yourselves a little bit your reaction to Hinduism. Why don't we just do that in common for 5 or 10 minutes or however long you want to stay and do it? What's your reaction to this religion of India? Keeping in mind that we only just scratched the surface, I just, you know, gave you some impressions at best, but I want that to be material for you to think about now, Christian theology. Can we learn something from Hinduism? Or do we have to say, well, you know, that really is just all wet? Janet?
Well, I have a question that's not very theological, but you know, theological implications, and that is, if you go through life doing your duty in the way of action and build up good karma, I guess, and anyway, have better and better rebirths, does your dharma change then in your next, you know, your next reincarnation? Would your dharma change?
Certainly. Your dharma is based upon your birth.
So you could hope for a higher social position in the next...
Yeah, but don't hope too much, because that's kind of what desires are.
Do they have a concept of hope?
What?
Do they have a concept of hope?
Well, I don't think they would express it that way. Their concept that would get closest to hope would be, kind of like dedication and or love, because that's the word in devotion, bhakti, love for your God, and the assurance that loving your God means that your God is not going to abandon you, but will, you know, bring you, so to speak, either to a higher rebirth or bring you to liberation or whatever. But no, I don't think the Christian notion of hope is really a part of it, because hope implies progress in this lifetime, at least, you know, in our, or heaven, you know, the hope of heaven. Now, you know, I suppose you could find something about it somewhere in Hinduism, but hope is very much like desire, and the Bhagavad Gita, you know, teaches over and over again to perform your actions without desire, without wanting fruits of your actions, right? Do them simply because they are your actions. And then the examples are given. Even the gods performed their duty. If Vishnu stopped performing his duty, the whole world would collapse, right? And so forth. So the whole ethical system is built upon that notion. Mm-hmm.
Their world has no beginning and end. This circular type thing.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense. Right, that's right. No beginning, no end.
You're all continuously be going around.
Well, there's these waves, you know, on the cosmic scale, everything devolves eventually, but then everything evolves again.
You have good gods and bad gods?
Well, there are some demons, demonic gods, sure. There's one of them associated with the birth of Krishna. Vishnu agreed to become incarnated as Krishna to destroy this evil god who was causing great havoc for the people. And then the evil god Kamsa heard about this and killed all of the children of this woman who was supposed to bear Krishna. And then Krishna was secreted away and raised among the cowherd people. So yeah, there are demons and bad gods, but they're not among the high gods. What about the question? Can we learn anything about God from this?
In relation to that question, one of the things that I just get the feeling of and responding to what I heard is the immensity of God.
Mm-hmm.
And the infinite smallness of the human creature, the absolute enormity of God. And I think in Western Christianity, with our marriage with Western philosophy and the importance of individuals,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't think God and human are as far removed in our system as the individual and Brahman, you know, reaching that point.
Yeah, I think it's a good point. The enormity of God as Brahman, right? Yeah.
Yes.
But now the individual is very close to God in other ways, like to Krishna, who is an incarnation of God, right? But that other dimension, the enormity of the divine, is something you certainly find in Hinduism. Now, isn't it there in Christianity too? Or have we maybe forgotten it? This is the kind of thing that I would want you to think about.
I
remember reading a book back in seminary days called Your God is Too Small.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I think we have... I think the God that we encounter in our average congregational service or whatever, I don't think that God is that enormous. I don't think we have an overwhelming sense of the breadth and the height and the depth and the sacredness of God when we go to encounter God on Sunday morning. I think, and some of that has to do perhaps with our scientific mind.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yeah, that's true.
How it's changed the concept of what God does and how that works in the world. Mm-hmm.
This is, I used the phrase yesterday too, Paul Tillich's phrase, that Christians need to recover some sense of what he called God beyond God, you know. And by that he simply meant that our normal conceptions of God are pretty small, you know. We kind of limit God in our usual thinking. And so every once in a while, it is helpful to realize that God is, you know, is this tremendously great mystery. Remember how St. Paul exclaimed, you know, the vastness of the height and the depth of the mystery of God beyond all human comprehension. Well, that's what this is. And, you know, maybe it's just a reminder to us. Look at your own notion of God. And that could be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got a question that kind of... stunned me a little bit. In Christianity, we don't have as large a God probably as they do in this religion here, because we have Christ instead.
Mm-hmm.
And as an individual, we have faith in Christ as our only hope. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Why is it necessary for us to go further than that?
Well, we don't. And certainly, Christ is everything. I mean, you know, if you read the New Testament, Christ is much, much bigger than we can imagine, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what Raymond Panikkar was getting at in the title of his book, The Unknown Christ of Hinduism. He works out a Christology that tries to pick up some of these cosmic ideas, you know, like at the beginning of the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God. And all things were created through the Word, and the Word became flesh, you know, and that is Christ. But, you know, we have to remember that greater dimension of Christ, too. But you're exactly right. You know, Christians don't need more than Christ.
But how can we convey that message out of our simplicity to a Hindu person and say, well, you know, I'm not trying to tell you you're wrong about your immensity, but... is unnecessary.
Well, I think you know, the point would be to share that with him. But then also, you know, then the second part of it is to listen to what they're saying, right? And that's the main thing that I'm trying to get at here, is just to listen to what they're saying. You know, it may seem very bizarre and strange and you know, and unnecessary and all kinds of things. But we're never going to be able to relate to our Hindu neighbors, you know, as neighbors, as fellow human beings, as fellow pilgrims, unless we listen to them. And, you know, in listening to them, well, we'll get some new ideas. We might even change a little bit.
What role does begging have? I heard that there were so many begging, and how does that fit in with not desiring, and I heard it always holding them that they don't work, they don't support themselves, they just beg, and
mm-hmm.
what Can you tell me about that?
Well, begging isn't the right word for it, really. That it actually is more of a Buddhist discipline. But yeah, I mean, if you see a holy woman coming down the street who is God realized and a sannyasin, you know, it would be a very important thing for you to give something to that person.
No matter
person.
How poor I am, I must give something. What? I don't deserve a blessing that.
A crust of bread or something. Mm-hmm. Actually, it's, you know, the social problems of India are very, very great, as you could testify to. The poverty and all kinds of things. So, to what extent the religion of Hinduism keeps society from changing and addressing some of the problems they have is a good question. But, you know, we can't really get into that tonight. We're just trying to understand a little bit of their vision of existence, because it's so different from ours.
What's a Hindu, let's say, person in the knowledge concept of how it all got started? Or is there a creation?
Well, there are many creation stories, but they're not absolute beginning stories. They just tell of the origin, but that happens many times, right? And it's a different way of looking at it from our Christian notion, which assumes there was a time when there was nothing, right? Now, to a Hindu, that's incomprehensible. You know, how can you possibly comprehend a time when there was nothing, right? Well, to us, it's incomprehensible to have a notion that there never was a beginning. And then that's something that really differentiates the two points of view. But maybe we can learn something from that, too. Maybe our concept of beginning and end, you know, is a little bit simplistic, too. I don't know. That's just a question. Yeah.
Well, also the different great gods that you mentioned present from seemingly, maybe this is the wrong way to put it, but from different aspects, creation itself. You don't just have one guy create the world at one time. There's people at one time, God, you could date for question in numbers. Mm-hmm. But here you've got three great gods, all involved in creation. Mm-hmm. You've got this world coming out of the navel of Vishnu. Mm-hmm. Then you also have another goddess.
Another goddess who gives birth to the world, right?
And you've got enough female imagery in that one, but no, you have to have two more.
Right.
So there's not only a feminine element in the design, but it suggests me a richer plethora of ideas of feminine in any other religion.
Yeah, but I think that's true. There's such a fullness of ideas, and the fascinating thing is that they Hindus don't feel any particular contradiction or conflict between them. You know, it's that notion that, you know, somehow or other everything is one, but there are so many different ways of experiencing it and expressing it.
I think although Gandhi lamented the caste system. As a lot of religions tend to make social cement
right.
for people.
Mm-hmm.
There is still something, though, in the notion of the Brahman dealing with the creative order, I think we as Christians can learn something from, not by crossing the line, say, into pantheism where every tree is God,
mm-hmm. right.
but I would say our creation myths and epics and theologies have definitely allowed us a much more user mentality
right.
and an ability to take life
mm-hmm.
out of very living things,
right.
even if they're inanimate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think here, that may be a little bit more protected because of the concept of Brahman in everything.
Well, that's true. All life is sacred in one way or another, you know, and that does lead to problems. You know, you've got cows walking about all over because, you know, the cow is particularly sacred. But, you know, maybe that's not the biggest problem in the world. In contrast to a notion that has developed in the West that, you know, that everything that's here in this world is simply objects for us to use, you know, a loss of at least the biblical sense of the majesty of God somehow or other reflected in that.
Definitely an interconnectedness
mm-hmm.
that has a really neat
mm-hmm.
Contribution.
Right.
How do they know which step on the ladder they are when they're babies? And I mean, and they, why don't they just decide they're on the top ladder at the beginning? It'd be easier, wouldn't it?
Good question. Well, you know, I guess as you know, as you grow up, you learn where you're at, and usually that's a function also of the class system. Those who are of the lower classes, the untouchables and the servant class, simply aren't expected to be spiritually advanced. The three higher classes are expected to be spiritually advanced, and they are, you know, given a religious education, and then some among them simply realize that they are at a high spiritual level and they go out and become the sannyasis. I mean, it's a self-selecting thing.
I think they all select the same thing.
Well, yeah, you think so. But they seem to know.
No fun climbing the ladder, you imagine.
And studying world religions, have you studied the New Age movement as a separate religion, or is it a subcategory?
Well, no, it's kind of a separate thing. I mean, New Age is one of the characteristics of whatever it is we mean by that is eclecticism. I mean, drawing a little bit from everything. Not being based in a single philosophy. I mean, even though this has everything in it, as I said at the beginning, it still is based in a philosophy. Yeah, but a New Age movement would pull out something from here and something from there and then something from somewhere
just
else.
Just as you've talked a lot of it, it sounds really familiar to the philosophies of, you know, all encompassing, except everyone.
Right. Well, I think that's true, those ideas of the oneness of everything and the presence of the sacred within us.
I am God.
And even for some people, the notion of reincarnation and whatever that is. Has kind of arbitrarily been pulled out from here. That's true, but I don't really consider that to be an integrated religion. And, you know, that's my prejudice as a historian of religions. I guess this is an authentic religion, right? And the New Age is kind of an eclectic drawing together. I mean, I think putting the best construction on it, you know, in a sense, we're all New Age people, I suppose, in that we are conscious of a lot of these things, and we learn from them. That's kind of what I'm asking you to do. You know, what can you learn from Hinduism? Maybe we can learn to experience God's presence a little bit more intensely in the mountains here, right? You know, that's not New Age, but, you know, maybe by listening to Hinduism, we might realize that, you know, God is present here. You know, that's, I think, different from a New Age philosophy.
In a Christian, you don't have to remain any particular thing. You can go as far as you want to go, or you can earn. You can't earn eternal salvation, but you can become assure yourself of salvation.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Hinduism, you don't ever get anywhere. I mean,
well, that's not completely true. You know, that's true at this from this perspective, the path of action is prescribed, and there are many good things about it that I didn't have a chance to say. I mean, it offers, you know, social security, built-in communal relationships and all kinds of things. But there are so many bad things about it, too. But in the worship of the gods, that's open to everyone. You know, you can become a devotee of the mother goddess and reach liberation through that. It depends on different people's temperaments and so forth. Well, I've kept you well over the hour that we're supposed to. I hope you keep thinking on these things. And.